Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored by the Bob Nelson Charitable Fund, honoring the San Diego Harbor Police Foundation.
Can I just say, doesn't it feel like a soothing balm to be talking about a Airbnb proposal on the Voice of San Diego podcast?
It
feels
is,
like
it
I'm
is.
Smearing VapoRub on my chest and inhaling deeply.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, joined as always by assistant editor Andrew Keats. Hello, Andy.
Hey, bud. How are we?
Pretty well, thank you. And managing editor Sarah Libby. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Okay, coming up on the show today, we have a lot to talk about with schools. We had a big story this week about how one school has racked up so many accusations from young girls who said teachers harassed, abused, and groomed them. We'll talk about that school. We have analysis as well of suspension rates across the region and how they break down along racial lines. Unfortunately, unsurprisingly, it's very disturbing. And we need to just talk about schools in general. We have a few more details about what's going to happen to them in the fall. We have even more questions than before, and obviously things are changing every day. And on the second half of the show, a conversation with Corey Briggs. I interviewed him about his numerous lawsuits against the city of San Diego and why he now wants to be the lawyer for the city of San Diego. So it's a big show this week. But first, classic Voice of San Diego podcast content. We've got to tune into a narrative that you might have thought was gone. You might have thought was drowned up in this era of crises about public health, the economy, the reckoning that we're all seeing in our institutions. No, there was a surprise deal announced this week between hotel workers union and a consortium of the biggest providers or facilitators of vacation rentals, all brokered by a San Diego City Council member not named Barbara Bree. Dr. Jen Campbell has come up with a proposal and a deal to try to get vacation rental regulations. Andy, what are the basics of this compromise announced in the eve, probably timed for the Voice of San Diego podcast Wednesday?
Yeah, they were like, yeah, that's definitely the case. So it introduces, a lot of it's similar to what we've seen in the past, like a new permitting and enforcement regime where the enforcement functions are paid for by the permit costs or any violations that it's charged, so that they hope it would be sort of cost neutral. But it introduces a tier system that I think sort of is new. I think it's new at least. So like Mission Beach would be in its own tier. They would have as many permits that as could handle up to 30% of the housing stock in Mission Beach. And they would kind of be their own little bubble. And then the rest of the city for whole home rentals, for rentals where the entire property is rented out all at once, the permits for that would be capped at 0.7% of the city's housing stock, which is something like, you know, it's like 3,000 something permits. So it would severely clamp down on the number that are operating today. And then there would be two lower tiers. One would be for rentals of like rooms within your house that would have no daily limitation and have no overall limitation. And then if you're going to do rentals for 30 days or fewer, There would also be no limitation on those, but you would have to get a permit. And then, so, but for that, you know, most crucial category, the whole home rentals where there is not a homeowner present, that would be capped at 0.7% of the city's housing stock. Homeowners could have only one of those permits at a time. So all of the people who own, maybe a dozen properties and run all, you know, operate all 12 of them throughout the city as something of a business, that would no longer be allowed. You could only do one permit per person or LLC.
So in essence, let's just do some quick review. So there was kind of unrestricted vacation rentals going on. They decided to start making them pay taxes and stuff like that. But then Mara Elliott, a few years ago, the city attorney says, these are all illegal and you guys need to come up with a way to regulate them. She's like, there's no place in them for the city zoning. And so therefore they are illegal, but she doesn't do anything and the mayor doesn't do anything to actually stop them. And so then they go through what turned out to be like 2 years of devastatingly torturous conversations about it. They got to a deal, or we thought a deal, but then remember Chris Ward, city council member, he got cold feet. He backs out of it. They end up hashing out a severe restriction of vacation rentals, basically said you can't do them except for, you know, your own house when you leave for a short period. Then the vacation rental platforms threw that out with a referendum, and now we're in this sort of moratorium period where they're still going on, but obviously nobody's traveling. It's just weird. And so to have this come up. Now, what's interesting is the deal was between the hotel workers union and these platforms. The hotel workers union, I think, can be credited, at least in large part, with the cold feet that Councilman Chris Ward got when he was coming up with that proposal. This whole mess, of course, led one city councilman, Chris Kate, to say, we are incapable of governance. Mm-hmm. After it failed one other time and after one of these marathon meetings. And so now this is brokered. It sounds like the essence of what you described, Andy, is that they said there is a cap on these. We will track the cap because we know who can get the permits or not and who's paying the taxes or not. And then we will cap them and we will allow Mission Beach, which was kind of a rogue actor in this because they don't mind it and they've traditionally had a bunch there. And then we'll limit the per person who's able to actually have this. So kind of the contours of what we had before, but now the hotel workers union's on board, which is an interesting political step.
Yeah, exactly. And so there were no other city council members during this press conference that Jen Campbell held yesterday to announce this deal, including the fact that Councilwoman Barbara Bree, who has been very involved in this discussion since she became a city council member, was also not part of it. And when I called to see what her office's take on it was, said that they were learning about it along with everyone else. So they were not involved in the negotiations. All of that to say, look, we've had an announced deal before, and it either didn't get city council votes or Airbnb wasn't on board, so they collected enough signatures to throw it out. So it's not at all clear that there's going to be enough votes to turn this into a law. So we'll have to watch that. But you know, that's the thing that does seem to be different is that the union is there. So whatever force that they applied in previous instances, that at least seems to be no longer at play.
Can I just say, doesn't it feel like a soothing balm to be talking about a Airbnb proposal on the Voice of San Diego podcast?
It
feels
is,
like
it
I'm
is.
Smearing VapoRub on my chest and inhaling deeply.
That's why I wanted to lead. I think it was a great idea to lead with this because we it's nice to remember
Imagine like in this present environment, if we just did a whole episode where we're just like, first up, Airbnb. Next, we're going to talk about the convention center. And after that, we'll discuss what's going to happen at SDSU West. Those are the only topics in the news right now. Moving on.
Sarah, if we had in the office a meeting about a series of columns we wanted to do about women's issues, but we left you out of them, It seems like that's probably the feeling that Barbara Bree has.
Right.
If there's a deal going forward about vacation rentals that she was completely left out of.
Amazing. One interesting thing is that I've been following this bill at the state level written by Assemblywoman Tasha Borner Horvath that would really sharply curtail the amount of vacation rentals in a lot of coastal areas in San Diego. She introduced that bill last year, but kind of moved it to a 2-year track. So it was still going on this year. And just this week, all the language from that bill got, as they say, gutted and amended, and replaced with a completely different, measure. So it's kind of interesting timing. I've reached out to them to see if it's related to this city council deal and haven't heard back. But so seems like at least on the state level, there's no longer something moving forward.
The other thing we should say is that council member Jen Campbell in 2020 deciding to throw herself into two of the most contentious issues in city politics. There will be a ballot measure on the November ballot. Well, it appears the case that there will be a ballot measure on the November ballot for raising the height limit in the Midway area, which has been a do not touch issue for a very long time. And now this as well may be settled by the time we go to the polls in November. So there you go.
Will Jen Campbell take on the People's Ordinance?
Yeah, right.
Is that the next?
Yeah. And not just a controversial issue, but controversial in her district. Like,
right.
It's like,
yes,
her,
that's
like,
true.
Straight. There was a funny tweet from Councilman Mark Kersey, who was famously or notoriously sort of frustrated with how all those negotiations went. And he said, I think this is a great idea. It should come to city council after December 10th when he'll be out of office. they're looking forward to that discussion. We'll see, of course, what the people on the coast and in these neighborhoods that have been so frustrated by these vacation rentals actually think. Seems like they probably still want a blanket ban.
The John Thixton's group, which has been outspoken on this for years, already sent out a measure that said that Councilmember Campbell abandoned San Diego communities.
Yeah, there you go.
There it is.
Well, we've reported for years about Westview High School. It's part of the Poway Unified School District, and the school has what we found is a disturbing pattern. Our Kayla Jimenez did a piece this week about an accusation against an employee at the school, and it's the latest in a string of sexual assault and harassment incidents to have surfaced there in the last 10 years. 5 of the 6 people who've been accused of or found to have engaged in inappropriate interactions with students in the last decade were athletic coaches at the school, and few of them faced any consequences. 2 are still employed. Sarah, you worked on this story all week with Kayla, got through all of our vetting processes, and it was a real, it's a big one. It's got a lot of traction online, a lot of shares, a lot of comments. What do you think resonates so much with this story?
Yeah, so there are a few things. I think the biggest thing in having tracked these stories and issues for so long are the patterns that emerge, and they're so clear and they're so consistent. And that was true even within this one school. So as Kayla pointed out and laid out, you know, so comprehensively, there were at least 6 different employees, 5 of whom were coaches at the school, in addition to being teachers, who had these interactions with students. Some of them escalated to actual physical relationships with students. And then others involved these coaches who were constantly texting students, often really inappropriate, sexual, sometimes really overtly sexual messages, and tried to, you know, take that to another level to actual physical relationships with those students. And in a lot of those cases, because they didn't actually escalate into physical relationships, the officials said, well, this doesn't warrant termination. In one case, a teacher lost his coaching position, but is still a teacher at the school. And now another student has come forward and put forward an online petition saying that one of these teachers texted her, you know, when she was a student and when she was a recent graduate, and that this is continuing to be a problem. We're seeing the same stories emerge over and over and over again. And yet nothing has really happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the common, you mentioned how this theme is so consistent. It's like you see these rather just horrid examples and pieces of evidence of what some educators do. And obviously a small fraction of the total population, but enough to really impact a lot of people. And then to systemically see them just not dealt with. They're usually just said, well, it's just once, it wasn't that bad, that kind of thing.
So one thing that really stood out to me when I was going through this story is, you know, like I said, there are six different educators, and so it's kind of hard to keep track of all of them. But while officials were investigating one of these teachers, they learned that at one point another student had reported to a teacher that this teacher they were investigating had slapped her on the butt and done other inappropriate things in the classroom, and that teacher at the time reported it to the principal, and that never went anywhere. The principal just kind of brushed it off, and it didn't really come forward until this same teacher was being investigated for new claims. And so, you know, all these teachers have accumulated complaints from multiple students before it really, you know, evolved into an investigation that they took seriously.
Yeah, and we've been doing so much investigative work about police officers. I can't help but see these parallels. We have two groups of public employees trusted with some of our most sensitive obligations in a society. The social contract we have with them, along with the actual contracts, are like very deeply dependent on trust. And that's what's so hard about all these stories, is that those social contracts being just systematically breaking, just being broken. And I wonder if there's anything, you know, in the parallel universe that you saw a bunch of conservatives talk about Kayla's story this week. You would see, you know, you'd see them look at what's happening in this uprising about the concern about policing and the racial reckoning that a lot of people are seeing happen. And they would be looking at that and say, oh, there's a group of people agitating about a public employee union and wanting to tighten grips on spending and analyze their spending as a public government. And we have a platform for that. And yet they still aren't bringing themselves around to that, but they'll jump right over all over this story.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the consistencies in the unwillingness to see them.
Yeah. Yeah. So Kayla's been doing, obviously this is part, you know, 100 or whatever of our long time series investigating some of these things. Kayla kept an eye on this. This kind of came up because of that petition you mentioned, right? This caught her eye and they decided to dig in and, you know, remind everybody what we were dealing with at that particular school. It's a well-known, very highly regarded school.
Yeah. And I think that kind of factors into it. They have a lot of really active and engaged parents who have consistently brought these issues to administrators and pressed them to do more. And at the same time, the school kind of credits this atmosphere where teachers do feel encouraged to have relationships with students and drive them to and from practice and be kind of buddies with them. They say that's what helps make it such like a special, close-knit atmosphere, so it's really kind of a double-edged sword.
Well, continuing on this theme with schools and some of the investigative work we've been doing, we had a great week, by the way, in investigative work. Our reporter, Will Hunsberry, analyzed district data from across the San Diego region from districts that are required now to produce their data about suspensions. And his analysis showed that Black students are far more likely to be suspended than any other racial group in San Diego County schools. He found that Black students are suspended disproportionately to their population. One middle school he looked at showed 30% of Black students were suspended at least once. Across the county, Black students make up about 5% of the student population, but 12% of the suspensions. He talked to some parents and others. You know, I don't think any of us were surprised by this. I think the one thing I was surprised by, I thought they had done a lot more to actually thwart suspensions. They'd been working so long on these alternative plans and such, but he really lays out how starkly they're just still just saying, hey, go home, we can't handle it.
So one of the most devastating things about this story, aside from the really comprehensive analysis he did, was he talked to this woman, Keshawna Christopher, who's actually a guidance counselor in San Diego Unified, who, you know, we've quoted several times before. I think we even made her a voice of the year because she was so outspoken and advocating for her students. She said that her 5-year-old son was suspended and had police called on him as a kindergarten student. So this is somebody whose mother is a well-known, you know, employee in the district. And even him being 5 years old couldn't escape having police called on him for something in the classroom. So that's just pretty mind-boggling.
I mean, I think this is where some of these issues become really stark for me. I remember kids who did some gnarly things in elementary school. But we've entered a phase, and obviously they had a privilege that when there was a conflict in schools, right now it seems like you mentioned the police, like if there's some sort of obedience problem, some sort of conflict, they have to assert physical almost control over what's happening, that there's no other imaginable outcome other than an escalation of force until it's shut down, until there's submission. And obviously,
boy, that sounds familiar right now.
And obviously that's being directed towards, you know, one particular group of people, and it's having consequences. I think for those kids, their whole career, we've talked for years about the school to prison pipeline. You lose traction if you miss school. You start to see yourself and people start to see you as one type. And then I look at like my own son, our own issues. And, you know, like sometimes when the resources aren't there to analyze like what really is going on, you know, do they need other services? Are there actual, sensory issues going on or ADHD or autism or something, and those aren't being necessarily dealt with. I remember Keshawna Christopher talked about that herself, that they weren't getting the type of IEP special services that she so clearly saw that they needed to at least be analyzed for, and they weren't even getting them.
Yeah, to state the obvious, this sort of punishment would not fly if it was being dispensed this regularly at different schools in the district. If it was being dispensed in predominantly white schools, it would stop. And I think it's easy. And I've attended some school board district meetings where they have provided informational updates on the types of things that they're doing to address these discrepancies. And it's very easy to get lost in the jargon and the educational buzzwords that they use to describe their response. And I think what the data shows unequivocally is that they're getting lost in it as well. And it there simply is not a meaningful change that is actually ending these outcomes and addressing whatever root causes they're responding to. Because, you know, this isn't new, and it's not even especially particular to San Diego. Whatever they're doing, because this isn't new, is obviously inadequate, and you know it's endemic to the fact that this wouldn't be allowed to fly in La Jolla.
I think that the point that you made, Scott, goes in the other direction too, because it's not just that kids who might need special supports, maybe that isn't being recognized and they're not getting those supports, but I think kids who are really gifted and have, you know, incredible potential, that's not being recognized because they're being flagged as having, you know, behavioral issues, or they're seen as being some sort of disruptive problem, and they're not being nurtured and supported in the ways that other students might be.
Yeah. Well, a great piece is from both Will and Kayla are on voiceofsandiego.org. I encourage you to check them out. It's nice to have some 1-2 punch of big investigative pieces while the region and the country deal with so many overlapping crises. And one of them I've been talking about a lot. So we mentioned earlier Westview High School in the Poway Unified School District. Well, teachers there and parents there and throughout Poway Unified School District this week put up a petition that now has almost 3,000 signatures demanding that Poway Unified come up with a hybrid option for going back to school. Poway was one of those that came out and said, we are going to let schools open and let students go back to physical schools, or they can have 100% online sort of homeschooling. And this group is demanding that they change course and that they have a hybrid plan because it's just not acceptable how they've been leaving it there. The petition reads, the current in-person back-to-school plan is unacceptable. There's nearly no difference between this plan and the pre-COVID school day schedules, the amount of students, the class sizes. It is not preventative or strict enough, especially with the current trend of rapidly increasing cases. You know, this was already a big deal, and now this spike in the virus and the outbreaks across the country has left people just completely beside themselves about what's going to happen, including me. And full disclosure, obviously, I've been thinking about this a lot. I've got three kids in different levels that we're worried about getting back into school, or not sure how we're going to keep doing our jobs. But also, you know, they need to keep going. So this really caught my eye this week as well. Your alma mater, Sarah, USC, not a cheap place to go to school. Unless way back in the olden days when you went, it was
it was not.
No. So in June, USC sent out a note saying, we're going to open. Classes are going to open. We're going to do our best to test people. It's going to be great. You know, stay tuned. And now, a month later, they've sent out a note saying that given the continued safety restrictions and limited densities permissible on campus, our undergraduate students primarily or exclusively will be taking their courses online in the fall. On-campus housing and activities will be limited. It's not what we hoped. We are now recommending all undergraduates take their classes online and reconsider living on or close to the campus. I mean, each one of these things that come out are just like another gut punch about the future. The New York Times has been doing some great pieces. They had one about the need to put focusing on schools above anything else. You should keep everything closed until you have a plan for opening. Schools, bars, everything else needs to just wait to get that settled, especially if they make the outbreaks worse. And then a great piece in the New York Times with a really provocative headline says, in this economy, you can either have a kid or a job. You can't have both. I don't know. I'm just having a real hard time with this issue because it's so uncertain. And, you know, with the spike that's coming back, you know, and if the spike is directly attributable to opening bars and restaurants, I can't help but be like mildly like raging inside, you know, what are we doing? And I think I'm having this reaction of like, well, you know, I understand why the county leaders don't talk about schools because it's the school district's thing. But this is exactly why that might be like really flawed thinking. Like if they did open things that made this worse, that will maybe lead to schools not being open, I can't help but feel like they made a grievous error precisely because they didn't want to talk about it because it's the school district's job, you know? And we've been in this place of like people saying, we need to talk about this. Well, we've been talking about it. When does it transition to like somebody literally taking the lead that's not necessarily, I mean, it has to be the governor and the president, frankly. Like the governor, the president punted everything to the governors, the governor has punted everything to the counties, and the counties punted everything to school districts, and now the school districts are punting them literally to the school site. It's just, it's a maddening situation.
I think we, I mean, we need to at least be open to the fact that it's not, it's an unsolved problem because people do not know the answer to it. That it's not a matter of just wanting to find a solution, but that it's actually a vexing problem and people keep punting because they can't figure it out. And no amount of focusing our attention on it will make it any easier or make the competing interests any less competitive.
I get that, but you know, schools in Denmark and other places, they manage. We haven't tracked any outbreaks to the schools that open in those countries. I think that's right. Like when it's like, well, of course America can't figure out this problem. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That makes sense, but that still hurts a lot. You know, that's still a painful reality. I think what's really interesting about it is that what we're realizing is that the act of education, of teaching kids something, is one thing, but that schools are probably like 80% the act of logistically managing so many bodies every day. And that got, like you said, a lot more complex based on this disruption, and it's just broken. It's broken that ability to sort of handle that, because it just added even just a little variable to what needs to change. It just really confused the process, and now I just don't know if some place like Poway can't have harmony between its parents and its teachers on what they should do. I just don't have a lot of hope for a much more diverse and large school district like San Diego Unified.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would add, though, is to compare it to Denmark and Europe more broadly, is Europe just didn't fall victim to the same sorts of false choices that we did. They acknowledged that every meaningful decision follows from controlling the virus, period. That a question of the educational system and the question of opening the economy are all subservient to the question about the controlling the public health crisis. And we didn't do that. So like, yeah, Denmark has managed to get schools back open, but Denmark has managed to suppress the virus where we haven't. So now that might circle back to your frustration with the relative hurry to open bars and restaurants before we had figured other things out. And so I take that point, but it's also, it's just a different framing around the same set of issues here, which is we can't be bothered to solve the root problem. And so of course we're going to be dealing with every secondary problem for that much longer.
Yeah. I mean, I think another point that people are finally starting, I mean, they keep saying we need to talk about this, but they've been talking about it a lot, which is that this is going to fall disproportionately on women. If they have, like they've been talking about in New York, and there's a big controversy about this plan to their kids in New York City are going to go back for a week, and then they're going to have 2 weeks where they don't go to school and they have to learn from home. And I mean, I think that gets back to like, we just can't have a functioning economy if what kids do during the day isn't solved. And I just hope, you know, this other op-ed that came out, there's a lot of talk about, you know, that we don't have a lot of evidence that they spread the disease. Like if we can work hard to make sure they have masks, that they spread out as much as possible outside and in other parts of the campuses, and then build a real world-class like platform for homeschooling for the people who don't want to be part of that. I think that's the answer, but and maybe that's what they're heading towards, but it just feels more uncertain the time goes off, especially when you have like San Diego Unified saying, we're not going to be able to even finish the year unless Mitch McConnell and the U.S. Senate gives us a massive bailout. So maybe that's a bluff, but certainly a bluff with my heart as the chips. Okay, this week I was able to talk with Corey Briggs. He's a longtime public interest lawyer, activist type. He's sued countless developers and city governments for, you know, not necessarily mitigating their environmental impacts to his standards, or also for not providing transparency in their documents and other things. He's been in trouble for not necessarily being very forthright about who he's representing or about the clients, or in some cases looking like he's actually pulled together the clients in controversial ways. And now he's running for city attorney. He's decided to be a politician. So I asked him, I took questions, and we spent a long time talking. The conversation originally aired on Voice of San Diego at Home. You can check out that live stream at voiceofsandiego.org/at home. voiceofsandiego.org/at home. We've been doing that every Monday and Wednesday, having good conversations and taking questions from the public. So this is my conversation with Corey Briggs. I think you're best known not for being a politician, but for being somebody who often tangles with them in court, or tangles with the people who work for them in court. I think you told the UT in January that you had sued the city 20 times. There may have been more since then. How many ongoing lawsuits do you have against the city of San Diego, and what are they about?
They run a range. Most of them have something to do either with open government, with not getting votes on raising money or incurring debt, or environmental issues. Probably about 15.
Oh, okay. And I think one of the main questions that comes right up from that, though, is would you have to recuse yourself from, you know, many different parts of the law? Were you to become city attorney and, you know, have influence over some of these issues that you sued about?
Well, on the cases, I would have to recuse. I can't. Uh-huh. I can't be a lawyer and flip sides. On the issues, if the issues are generic issues that come up, I don't have to recuse. I know something about it, and I give my best advice based on the information we have, and we go forward. But on the actual lawsuits, I'd have to recuse.
Mm-hmm. I was covering City Hall back in 2004. When we watched candidate for city attorney and later city attorney Mike Geary, he really had a revolutionary effect on defining what the city attorney's role was. His view was that the city attorney was elected, and he pointed to flyers when that change was made in the 30s that said that the people were the city attorney's client. And in many cases, he found himself squaring off with members of the city council, accusing them of various levels of corruption, the mayor and other city staffers who he would tangle with. He very clearly saw his role not as accountable to them, the city council, the mayor, but as accountable to the people. And I think he also realized like how powerful that role was. And even though the two city attorneys since him, Jan Goldsmith and Mara Elliott, have both run on the idea that they weren't going to be that way, they have both, to a certain extent, realized just how powerful that office is as a almost veto or, you know, definitely a powerful place in City Hall. You can make things not happen or make things happen from that spot. And to various degrees, both her and Jan Goldsmith have done that. What do you see your role? Were you to become city attorney, what do you see the role of the city attorney being in that sort of frame?
Well, so let's make sure your viewers know that the city attorney really has three jobs. One is to advise the mayor and the city council and the departments. Another one is to represent the city and city officials in court. And the third one is misdemeanor and infraction prosecutions. Those are really the three roles. I view the city attorney's position like this. The client is the city of San Diego. I am accountable to the voters. The voters will decide whether I do a good job or not, whether they reelect me. They are the ones who put me in office. I give advice to the mayor and the city council. They're the ones who have to make the decisions. I'm not the decision maker. So I put forward my best legal advice. I make sure the public knows about it because I want the public to know that I'm doing my best, and I want the public to know what information it is that the mayor and the city council have when they make their decisions. If the mayor and the city council make good decisions, they get credit for it. If I give good legal advice, I give credit for it. If they make bad decisions and I gave good legal advice, that's on them. But my motivation is to protect the city, to protect the taxpayers, to honor the will of the voters. They're the ones that I'm ultimately responsible to. And they are putting me in position to go work with the other team members, the team members being the mayor and the city council and the departments.
We're seeing a ballot measure move forward right now about that specific role. Like you said, they have the role of the misdemeanor enforcement, the prosecutions of misdemeanors. They have the role of advising the city council and of doing litigation such. But this ballot measure would strip the litigation and the advice from the elected city attorney and instead make it so the city attorney as an elected person was only responsible for prosecuting misdemeanors within the city of San Diego. Is that a ballot measure you support?
Well, this is a concept right now, right? The ballot measure hasn't actually been written. I'm going to do whatever the voters say. If the voters don't want to have an elected city attorney on the advisory and representation side, that's fine. I will be in there to help wrap it up and fulfill their will. If they decide that they want to have somebody in there who's independent, I will fulfill that will too. But I'm going to follow the will of the voters just like I do all the other times.
So, but surely you have a view about whether it should be an elected position or not.
Oh, if Mara Elliott were my attorney, I'd want a new attorney too. So I understand exactly why the city council, I mean, Republicans and Democrats, she's certainly united. She's bridged the partisan divide in that respect. I think the voters will decide whether they want to have a say over who is a legal advisor or not. I defer to them.
So just to be clear, you don't have any perspective on whether it should be an elected post or not.
I can see the arguments that go both ways. I understand that there are concerns about it being a politicized office. It clearly has been hyper-politicized under Mara Elliott. It also hasn't given good legal advice to the mayor and the city council. They've gotten into a lot of problems that bear the city attorney's seal of approval. So if I were in their situation, I certainly would want somebody different. They don't get to go out and campaign for me. So their choice is to say, well, maybe we get rid of this person. I think the voters need to, we need to have that argument. Does it make sense if you're going to get rid of that role to have the city attorney continue to have criminal responsibility over misdemeanors and infractions? That's a huge chunk of the budget. Would people want that to go to the district attorney or stay in the city? I think you have to have all of those conversations, and we just don't know enough about it yet to have that meaningful conversation.
Okay. Feels like we're dealing with three major crises right now. One is this public health crisis. The other is this economic crisis, people losing their jobs all across the region, all across the country. And then there's this third crisis, the crisis about the trust in public institutions, including at the center of that right now is various law enforcement efforts across the country, whether it's ICE and Border Patrol or whether it's local public police officers within right. cities and states. Mm-hmm. You wrote an op-ed for the UT and you said, for too long, politicians have done their best to push wages down while union bosses counter with bad cop protections and promises that the union will endorse and spend money on politicians when they run for re-election. What you're saying there is that instead of giving them actual money, they exchanged that for, they said, well, we can't give you money. We'll just protect your worst actors. Is that what you're implying there?
Yeah, there's a trade-off. You get what you pay for. And if you're going to be insisting on pushing down wages, obviously the union's going to negotiate something in exchange. If you want the best police officers, you're going to have to pay for the best police officers. And when you do, it allows you to say, no, we're not going to keep the bad apples around and we're not going to protect them. But we've done this. It's this, we do this dance every few years. And that, look, that's symbolic of a lot of things that we do, right? The politicians, you know, they get beaten up when they overpay. But right now, the public is getting to see the consequences of us not having nothing but the best on the street. Right. If you allow a few bad apples out there, you have serious problems. And that's a consequence of the way this relationship has worked. The unions protect bad members. The politicians get to claim victory for, you know, a fair deal for the taxpayers. And then the unions turn around and support the incumbents. That's the way this game works. And we need to call it out. We need to acknowledge that that's the way it's been done for a long time, and then we need to say no more.
You've been pretty critical of the police union, the Police Officers Association in the city of San Diego. You've hammered Mara Elliott, the current city attorney, for getting their endorsement. And just to be clear, that's not something you wanted or sought at any point?
No.
And why? What is it about police unions that you don't want to associate with?
Well, I don't think that any public official should be out seeking endorsements from people who do business with the city. Mm-hmm. I just think that's fundamentally wrong. I also think that prosecutors, and the city attorney is part prosecutor, should be like judges and should be swearing off of the endorsements from the political players. Everybody needs to have confidence that the city's top law enforcement official, and that's what the city attorney is. But the top law enforcement official in the city is beholden to nobody except the public's interest and to the voters. And when you start taking these endorsements from people who are doing business with the city, who have inside tracks, who are special interests, people legitimately question whether your loyalties are to the public or to those special interests. I just swear off of it altogether. You know, you mentioned you've been covering City Hall since 2004. You know that I've been there even since then. And my single biggest issue has always been, can the public trust what the government's doing? Are we turning square corners? Are we being fully transparent? Are we being completely honest? That has been a problem. That's not a new problem. It has been the motivating issue for me since moving back to San Diego in 2002. You and I have, you know, our paths have crossed a number of times on issues of government being trustworthy or not. Most recently, I think, with the school district hitting the delete button on millions of emails. And I take a pretty firm, unforgiving stance on transparency and making sure that we follow the rules, because that's what separates us from places where most people don't want to live.
On this question of police, sometimes I hear things later and realize they were interesting. You said, you know, we don't have the best police force because we don't pay enough. Are you actually saying that we should pay officers significantly more?
Yes, I think that the officers that we hire should be able to afford to live in San Diego. They should be able to afford to raise their families and be part of the fabric of our communities. And we don't have that now. We have officers who are commuting an hour or more. That's not, you know, what you hear politicians often say that we can police ourselves, right? Is it in various contexts? Yeah, we should be policing ourselves. And our officers should be our neighbors. And we don't pay our officers enough to be our neighbors.
You're saying, I think, something that I can grok, which is the idea of, like, look, we should have the finest people, but we should also have the finest oversight of them. We should be able to evaluate and remove them quickly if needed. One of the arguments against that historically in public employee situations is that a political actor, if given freedom to fire public officials, public employees, would use that inappropriately, and that thus public employees, teachers, police officers need to have intense protections against that, and that's why it's so hard to fire them. I mean, do you have a response to that?
Well, some of that's already written into the law for police officers. We have the Peace Officers Bill of Rights. What I'm talking about is the city's union contract that goes beyond that, right? At the city level, we can't change state law. That's above our pay grade. But we shouldn't be negotiating protections for bad officers. Yet we've done that in the contract right now, and we've repeated it over a dozen times since we did the contract about 5 years ago. So, yeah, if you are going to be a public official, you're going to have to turn square corners. You're going to have to be completely transparent. You are held to a higher standard. It's a significant responsibility. It's a tough job, but we have to hold people to high standards. When we don't, we end up with problems, and we're seeing that now.
It's kind of the opposite of defund the police then. You want to fund them, but in exchange get some power.
Well, defunding the police, that's a somewhat different issue. I'm talking about having community policing. You can't have community policing if your police officers don't live in the community. This is by definition. So we should make it so that our officers can live there. Now, I realize that the city recently created a program where officers can get a loan. Apparently, we've gotten some matching money to do that. That's all fine and good, but we should have been doing this for a long time. The point of the comment that you read from my op-ed is that for a long time, we've been ignoring this, and it needs to be part of the normal way we do business. Our officers should come from our community. We should do everything we can to have San Diego officers, so San Diego residents patrolling San Diego streets. What you ask the officers to do, that's the defund the police issue, and that's a separate question. But we should have San Diegans, they should be able to afford to live here, raise their families here, and be part of our community.
But you are on board with that sort of middle idea of the defund movement, which is I feel like, let me just add context, there's sort of two iterations of defund police. One of them says, start over, disband everything, and rebuild a community policing system or public safety system from the ground up. And then a second version says, we have added too many responsibilities to the police departments. It's making it so that they respond with weapons, firearms, to situations that do not need to get that violent. And thus, we should cut out all those situations, defund that, and fund some other response to those situations. I would gather from what you said, you're kind of on that latter camp.
Yeah, I think that's where San Diegans are. Right? San Diegans are a fair-minded bunch. They see what's going on in the protests. Nobody thinks that others should have to suffer an injustice that they aren't willing to suffer themselves. San Diegans are there. At the same time, San Diegans, in large part, are satisfied with the police department. There's room for improvement, but the majority of San Diegans are not in favor of getting rid of police and starting from scratch. That's why in my op-ed I said we need to be asking the questions that we've not been asking for a long time, and that is, what do we expect of police officers?
One more point on this criminal justice such stuff. You made a point in one of these emails that Mara Elliott keeps a secret, quote, Brady list, a list of officers known to falsify police reports and then lie in court, but she refuses to disclose it. If we want ethical and competent cops, we must equally insist on ethical and competent city attorney. She blasted that. She sent out her own letter. It was a little bit vague. It was hard for me to quite understand her point in it, in the sense, but what she was basically saying,
you weren't alone, Scott.
She was basically saying, we don't release that. What we do is provide it to defense attorneys when their clients are accused of something, and the police officer's word is the accusation, is the heart of the accusation. So we disclose potential challenges with that officer's word, with their ability to be trusted, when it's appropriate. And she said, quote, the Brady list protects the rights of the accused by ensuring that those records of misconduct are fully disclosed to defense attorneys. Why is that inadequate?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, the Brady list is different from Brady evidence. Brady evidence is what the Supreme Court says prosecutors must turn over to defense lawyers and to the accused if there's any exculpatory evidence, any evidence of bias or dishonesty by the police officers involved in the case. The list is the list that Mara Elliott compiles of officers that she knows are dishonest. They've been proven dishonest. That's separate from the Brady evidence that you give to a particular individual defendant. I can't think of why you would know that there's an honest officer who's out there collecting a paycheck and a pension, and you know the officer is dishonest, and you keep that secret because you know if you put that officer on the stand, you could lose your bar license. That's what this is about. If you put a dishonest officer on the stand knowingly, you know the officer's going to tell a lie, you know the officer's manipulated evidence, the lawyer loses the lawyer's license. If you protect those officers, you're essentially just trying to protect yourself. Those officers have no business being on the street. They have no business being on the public's payroll. So there shouldn't be a Brady list. If you know the officers are dishonest, you should take action to do something about it. The other reason her memo was disingenuous is because she can prosecute dishonest officers. It is a misdemeanor to falsify a police report. It is a misdemeanor to work with somebody to procure false evidence in a case. If those are the reasons why you have people on your Brady list, it's absolutely within your purview to do something about it. And yet she has done nothing. You can go look at the court records. We don't have any cases of the city attorney's office under Mara Elliott going after dishonest cops, yet she acknowledges she has the list. She even said in writing that it's better for the public not to know whose name is on the list. That's a problem. And the third point with the Brady evidence is that in California, it doesn't have to be turned over until shortly before trial. But most cases are resolved through a plea bargain, which means defendants are admitting to crimes, often lesser crimes, that get reduced so the prosecutors don't have to put on their case. They agree before they've seen the Brady evidence, because the Brady evidence doesn't have to be turned over until shortly before trial. So if you're cutting a deal because you're afraid of what's going to happen to you, and the prosecutor has not told you that there's exculpatory evidence, that's not right. And this whole idea of holding back, it reveals an attitude that the goal of prosecutors is to get convictions. That's not correct. The Supreme Court has said this many times. Other courts have said it many times. The prosecutor's job is unique. Unlike private lawyers whose job it is to get a good outcome for their clients, the prosecutor's lawyer is to achieve justice for the system, for the public. And sometimes that means not getting a conviction. Mm-hmm. So if your goal is just to get conviction numbers up, that's wrong. So I have a lot of problems with the Brady. There's one other issue, and that is when it's secret, you can have good cops put on it because they wouldn't politically support the prosecutor, right? They wouldn't endorse, they wouldn't cut a favor. And they get put on this list and then they get blacklisted. They can't get promotions. They can't get other opportunities. That's not okay either, right? We need to celebrate the good officers, not put them on a blacklist because they won't, yield to the will of the prosecutor and political things.
So you would publish the list, by the way?
I just wouldn't have a list.
Oh, okay.
There's the officers who are known to be dishonest need to be prosecuted, or they need to be moved on so that they cannot be in a position to harm people or harm the system. The good officers should not be on a list.
One of the recurring criticisms that you face is that you've sued so many developers and agencies and such on behalf of clients who are often hard to identify. It's often hard to find them. You sometimes refuse to disclose them. You faced criticism even from judges and sanctions. Do you have a response to that? Is there sort of an overarching way to explain that sort of constant thing that's dogged you as a public interest lawyer?
There's two ways to explain it. Every time I represent an organization, when we go into court, some member of the organization has to identify himself or herself. So it's simply false to say that my clients are not known to the courts. This issue has been litigated in court several times. Every time the judges say, yes, these are the people, we agree with Mr. Briggs's clients. Because it's salacious to write a story that Briggs doesn't have clients, that's the part that gets published. Nobody publishes the follow-up that says, no, the judge said everything was legit. The other part of it is, you know, that whole story came up several years ago. It was part of a smear campaign. I've responded to it and explained why it was not true. It's been investigated by the state bar. The state bar has more than once given me a clean bill of health. But it's just something that folks who don't want an outsider in the city attorney's office like to drum up and, throw out. It comes with the territory. That's fine. But
have you ever created a client to represent as opposed to a client come to you to represent?
No.
Corey Briggs, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, and, Scott.
We'll probably bring you on again before this all gets resolved. I appreciate you coming on.
I look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast. It's the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. Keep up with all of our big investigations and daily news with the Morning Report. We put that together for you every weekday. Sign up at vusd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby is Managing Editor. And this show is produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.